tourists have seen Italian gangster movies such as Goodfellas and The Godfather. Movies that pride themselves on being grounded in reality and portraying a true reflection of life in the mob. I think we all felt the impact of shock when Joe Pesci's character was beaten to death by a group of guys with baseball bats at the end of Casino, then buried alive. Or when the same character tortures a rival gang member by placing his head in a vice and popping his eye from the socket. Life in the mob is vicious, violent, and cutthroat. But how accurate really are the movies? Henry Hill, who is the main protagonist in Goodfellas, always said the movie got the feel, look, and portrayal of gangster life in the 60s, 70s, and 80s spot on. But Henry Hill was a fairly low-level hustler, a thief and drug dealer for the most part, who clearly got his hands dirty, but did not, I feel, have a universal, one-size-fits-all experience of mobster life. Martin Scorsese and Francis Ford Coppola, in making their gangster epics, like many lesser directors that followed, were always consistent in glamorizing mob life, and in most cases, that might have been accurate. But not always, as tonight's episode will show. This is The Life and Horrors of Richard Kuklinski, Part 1. Richard Kuklinski is a former hitman for the New York Mafia's notorious Five Families. The lines have been very blurred over the years since his arrest in December 1986 as to whether Kuklinski should be classed as a hitman or indeed a serial killer, as it is estimated in his career that he killed up to around 200 men, and not all with financial gain, as would be the case for a run-of-the-mill hitman. Over the next two episodes, I'm going to talk about the complex character of Kuklinski, whom later became more famously known by his nickname, the Iceman. Who was he? Who was he as a man? Where he came from? How he led a double life as both family man and mafia associate, and also discuss his career, his hits, and the more gruesome details of his work. What's incredible and worth noting about Kuklinski is that he was extremely good at what he did. He carefully planned and researched everything, and he had a reputation as someone that, as soon as he accepted the hit, that person was a dead man walking. Because Kuklinski never, not once in his career, failed to make a kill. Kuklinski was 6'5" and 300 pounds, making him no small fry. But even though his huge frame might have given the impression he was slow, he was in fact very quick and very intimidating. With his bosses, his family, his friends, and everyone he ever met fearing him, he was quiet, calculating, and it didn't take a lot for him to develop a dislike into you, which meant inevitable death. Childhood. Richard Leonard Kuklinski was born on April 11, 1935, in Jersey City, New Jersey. Richard was one of four children that Stanislaw Kuklinski, a Polish immigrant rail worker, and Anna McNally, an Irish immigrant who worked in a meatpacking factory, had parented. Richard's household was an abusive one. Richard's father would inflict daily beatings on the children and his wife. His wife Anna would also inflict her own form of physical violence on her children with her strict Catholic disciplinarian approach to parenting. Richard would later say it was not uncommon for his father to knock him and his siblings unconscious and break their bones, and their mother, who he later referred to by the affectionate name of just Cancer, she would on many occasions would break broom handles over the backs of the children. This abuse all occurred way below the age of 10 for the children, and violence became a way of life for them. Richard would say that just the sound of hearing his father's voice would make him wet himself, which of course would only instigate further or more vicious beatings. In fact, at the age of 8, Richard's older brother Florian was beaten so severely by his father that he slipped into a coma and died after he was left on the kitchen floor following his ordeal. Florian's father, Richard's father, had beaten him unconscious and eventually to death. When it came to reporting the death, the Kuklinskis told the authorities that Florian had simply fallen down the stairs to his death. The authorities and the neighbors all believed this. There was also an instance where Richard was suffering a particularly bad beating by his mother, where she hit his head so hard with a broom handle that it knocked him out cold for several hours. Richard said that again he was left on the floor of their apartment to bleed unconsciously, and when he woke up, it was a long while before he could remember his name or where he was. Life wasn't much easier outside of the home either. Richard, by the time he was 12 years old, was tall, but he was skinny and kind of a late bloomer. He also endured beatings and bullying from neighborhood kids and schoolmates too. On one particular occasion, Richard was chased by two bullies home who caught up with him near the entrance to the building of his tenement. The two boys severely beat Richard before he could run into his building and into his apartment. When he told his father what had happened in the hope of gaining some support, his father then beat Richard and threw him back out until he could defeat the two bullies himself. Defeat them he eventually did, single-handedly, and it was at this point that he began to realize that he could make personal gain from violence. Using his fists could give him what he wanted. Don't be fooled, however. Richard was no angel as a child. Yes, he was an altar boy, but by the same time he was a teenager, the years of abuse that he had suffered at the hands of his parents had made him devoid of emotion and devoid of the rational fear that most of us are supplied with at birth. He would torture stray animals in his neighborhood, tying the tails of two cats together and throwing them over a clothesline so that the cats would tear each other to shreds. He would also often catch live cats and put them inside a tenement basement incinerator boiler and watch them succumb to the flames. Through the glass, he could see them being burned alive. He didn't stop there. He would pour gasoline over dogs and light them on fire, bludgeon cats and dogs to death, and also tie dogs to the rear bumper of buses and trucks to watch them get dragged to their deaths. Throughout all of this, Richard was seeking emotion that wasn't there. He would later say that he tortured the animals to see if he would ever feel anything emotionally, but that he never did. By the age of 13, Richard began stealing. First food to feed himself and his family after his father up and left, shacking up with another Polish woman. Then later, he stole cars too. One of the things he stole each week was a true crime magazine from his local drugstore. Richard was fascinated by the stories in there, but it led him into accepting that the only things he would ever be good at would be crime and violence. A young age to be settling and accepting your fate. Richard took particular interest in the macabre tales of murder in the magazines, and it gave him the idea to finally get revenge on his neighborhood bullies. He planned to kill the leader of their group, a boy by the name of Charlie Lane. His plan was a simple one. He removed a clothes hanging pole from his closet and confronted Charlie one night when he was alone on the street. Charlie immediately called him a dumb Polack. This enraged Richard immediately. Richard lashed out and hit Charlie on the side of the head above the left ear. Charlie immediately fell to the ground, but Richard kept hitting and hitting and hitting and hitting, eventually breaking the pole. So then he started kicking Charlie in the face and head, kicking and stamping and kicking until Charlie's body went limp and lifeless. He had killed him. Richard knew right away that he had to dispose of the body, so he stole a car, bundled the body of Charlie Lane into the trunk and began to drive, the whole time feeling more and more powerful and more invincible. Once Richard arrived at the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, he pulled Charlie's body out of the trunk and, knowing from his true crime magazines how police identify murder victims, cut off all of Charlie's fingers and toes and pulled out all of Charlie's teeth using a hunting knife and hacking at his gums. What was left of Charlie's body, he threw into the Hudson River to sleep with the fishes. Excitedly, Richard said, he drove home, gleefully throwing fingers and toes and teeth out of the window as he drove. Richard would later recall in prison that this was the first time in his life that he felt like he was someone who deserved respect. He was 13 years old. A missing persons report was filed for Charlie Lane in 1948. And extensive searches were made for the boy, but no one knew what had happened to him and no body was ever found. Until, of course, Richard Kuklinski told authorities of the crime in 2003. Following the murder of Charlie Lane, and with his newfound confidence, Richard first went after each and every member of Charlie Lane's friends and the boys who had always bullied him, beating them senseless and letting them know he was effectively taking control and power. He also got hold of a baseball bat and with his hunting knife went all over Jersey City and gained revenge through savage beatings, stabbings, and knife slashings over everyone who had ever wronged him. This, of course, also got him thrown out of school once his violent side came into the classroom, but Richard didn't care. He was done with school and he knew where his future lied. Now that he was no longer in school, Richard began hanging out at pool halls, and it wasn't long before he bought his first gun on the black market there. He also became very good at pool, and earned extra money by utilizing those skills through pool sharking. Then, one night, at a bar called Danny's in Jersey City, Richard began a game of pool with a local off-duty police officer for money. As the game proceeded and the policeman fell further and further behind, he began calling Richard names with every point he would score. This enraged Richard, but he didn't act. He eventually won the game. They had several words, but ultimately Richard left. He waited, however, outside the bar for a few hours until the policeman came out. Richard watched him drunkenly stumble out of the bar and walk to his car. He got in his car, rolled the window down slightly, and lit a cigarette. He took a drag of the cigarette and then passed out. Richard didn't act right away. Instead, Richard ran down the street to a nearby gas station and purchased several gallons of petrol in a can. He then returned to the policeman's car, poured all the petrol over him, and lit it on fire. Richard said that he stuck around so that he could see him burn, hear him scream, and smell his cooking flesh. Following this, Richard sank deeper and deeper into crime, robbing warehouses, liquor stores, and after a short period of time was noticed by Newark's De Cavalcanti crime family. As Richard was of Polish descent, he could never be a made man. He could never officially climb the ranks of the Mafia. The most he could achieve was Mafia associate, but this, he saw, was his key to bigger money. The De Cavalcanti family gave him his first hit at the age of 17, which Richard completed with aplomb, with no complications and no questions asked. He identified the man they wanted dead in the parking lot of a grocery store, and in broad daylight, he walked up to the man and shot him beneath his chin, killing him dead instantly. Richard was now in the club, and he would be given numerous jobs over the next few years, paying more and more in compensation for his abilities and skills. But Richard, by this point, had also developed a huge gambling addiction, so no matter how much he earned, he would always squander it pretty fast and need more to fuel his habit. His bloodlust had also deepened when, by 1954, not willing to only wait for Mafia hits to come his way, he also hunted the streets of Lower Manhattan in Hell's Kitchen for lone men at night to kill, just so that he could perfect his art and he could hone his skills. He would shoot, stab, bludgeon, beat, maim, and slay anyone who rubbed him up the wrong way or who he didn't like the look of, then either leave the body where it fell or throw it in the Hudson River. It got so bad the police had identified that there was a lot of murders happening in the Hell's Kitchen area, but they had come to the conclusion that the murders were the result of the homeless and hobos in the area fighting and turning on each other. It didn't occur to the police that there was a serial killer on the loose. Now, some estimates would put the number of homeless and random men that Kuklinski killed during this period as high as 50 or 60, which seems insane. How can this many murders go on in such a small district of Manhattan and no one realize there was a maniac on the loose killing loads of people? Well, you have to remember that this was the mid to late 1950s. No crime statistics were kept for New York at this time. Further, each police station essentially worked in silo and didn't communicate amongst each other. Further, a lot of the bodies went into the Hudson River, remember? So these could have washed up in any number of the five districts and also New Jersey. This would spread out the number of precincts who would go on to identify bodies during this time. Also, and this is a fairly big also, Richard had the genius idea during this particular killing spree to target gay men who would be coming out of known gay bars and clubs. Richard knew, as was the culture at the time, that if he killed an obviously gay person, then the police's own prejudice would stop them from investigating their deaths. And do you know what? It worked. Now, by this point, Richard had been dating a woman called Linda, who was 9 years his senior. Just like his father's relationship with his mother, Richard knocked her around. By the time he was in his early 20s, Linda had fallen pregnant. Initially annoyed by this, Richard tried to make Linda lose the baby by punching her in the stomach. However, this didn't work. So, he offered to marry her. This marriage was Richard's first. He would go on to father 2 children, but later said of those children and his wife at the time, Linda, that he never loved any of them at all. Now, about this time, Richard was offered a pretty big mob hit from the De Cavalcanti family. This was an important one, they told him. They wanted a used car salesman, a specific one, dead, because he had disrespected a made man's wife. Further, they wanted Richard to bring back a piece of him. So with this in mind, Richard stalked the gentleman for a few days before making his move. He approached him and hit him over the head, knocking him unconscious, then bundled his body into the trunk of a car. Richard drove to the Pine Barrens in New Jersey, where he had dumped his first murder victim several years before, and he tied the man to a tree. Richard could tell that the man knew why he was here and what he intended to do. Richard, with the dull end of a hammer, smashed the man's kneecaps and ankles, then chopped off all of his fingers. The man was fully awake, alive, and conscious throughout this entire ordeal. Richard's initial plan was to take back some fingers as a prize for his employers, but with the man tied to the tree and screaming in agony, Richard came up with a better idea. Richard killed the man using a gun, but then with a hatchet, he hacked off the man's head and delivered it to his employers in a simple plastic grocery bag. Richard would later say that his employer just smiled when he received it and handed him $10,000 in cash. Following this hit, Richard now gained a nickname amongst the mob. He was known simply as the Pollock, but no one knew anything else about him. What his full name was, where he lived, that he had a family, nothing. And Richard liked that. He liked having two lives. He liked keeping his family life separate from his mob life. He also got a reputation for filling the mob hits just as the mob wanted. And the hits got weirder and weirder. The DeCavalcantes would next ask him to kill a mob boss for them. So once again, he abducted the man and took him to the Pine Barrens. He broke all of his ribs, both arms, and his collarbone, and then smashed his head in with a rock. Finally, he placed all of the man's credit cards up his ass to leave a message for the enemies of the DeCavalcante family. So tonight we've covered the childhood and teenage years of Richard Kuklinski, the Iceman, and he already has a wide plethora of murders under his belt. In the next episode, which drops on Wednesday, we go a little deeper into his life as a married man with children, and him getting in deeper with the mob, where all this in part one will seem like sweet bedtime stories in comparison to the horrid and barbaric crimes that Richard will commit. Make sure you tune in and subscribe so you never miss an episode. While you're at it, why not follow us on Instagram, where we post daily with tales of the macabre, insane, mysterious, and disturbing. You can find us at dead_souls_podcast. Until part two on Wednesday, here is the Iceman himself in an interview from prison.
Would you ever use a chainsaw? I mean,
to cut someone up? Yes. I've done that. To dismember them, yes. Not to kill them, though.
No. What was it like to cut somebody up with a... the other guy's dead. How did it feel to cut some guy up with a chainsaw?
Well, I didn't have any feeling one way or the other. That just happened. That's the way it had to be.
Messy.
Yes. Yes, it was.
Did it make you sick?
No. I've had requests where the guy wanted the guy's tongue cut out. And he also wanted his tongue put in his rear end. So I believe there was a definite point he wanted to get across. I have an experience that I don't know if I should tell you or not. That it probably would offend a lot of people. I don't know, I don't think I should. I'll go into that.
Go ahead.
Nah, it's not a good one.
No, go ahead. Come on.
There was a man who was begging and pleading and praying, I guess. And he was police guarding all over the place. So I told him he could have a half hour to pray to God. And if God could come down and change the circumstances, he'd have that time. But God never showed up. And he never changed the circumstances. And that was that.